KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
In from the cold, there are extremists who have given up arms and are sitting in Parliament. It's not as if Afghans aren't working on this, you know.
And the U.S., Trump?
Trump is not interested in diplomacy. That seems evident on a global basis.
We're going to leave it there, and people can pick up the book and find out the other remarkable stories that this book is chock full of. Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the sequel to Steve Cole's Ghost Wars, the Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden. Professor Cole is Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Voices from the Edge is next with our guest host, Greg McKelvey from Portland's Resistance. KBOO's Kickstarter just launched today. Our goal is to increase free points of access to broadcast through trainings and workshops. Help us build a city of media makers by joining and sharing our Kickstarter campaign. And thank
you. KBOO is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
When radio got taken over by advertising, people in Portland decided to do it themselves. And in 1968, they created a space that was free from advertisers and independent from corporate or mainstream media interest. KBOO Community Radio. This is the very essence of DIY culture. KBOO was here in the 70s as people were taking back music spaces, in the 80s when artists were taking back music distribution, and in the 90s supporting small press revolution and all movements of self-expression. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY radio. Join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
February 13th, 1983, KBOO Community Radio held an open house to celebrate moving into a building that we could come to own here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the open house moving-in party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KBOO. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
Good morning, my name is Greg McKelvey, and you are listening to Voices from the Edge on KBOO Radio. Today we have a couple guests. In the beginning, we're going to talk about Village of Hope, if any of you have heard about it, and then we are going to have an interview with the somewhat interesting Cameron Winton. If you want to, and then in the end, of course, we'll be taking your calls. If you want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. I also want to mention that KBOO just started their Kickstarter campaign this morning. So if you go on KBOO's social media or any of those things, and you can get involved with that. So let's get right into the show. Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Steve Kimes. I'm a village member of Village of Hope and pastor of Onowing Christian Community.
Sure. So tell us about Village of Hope. Sort of, what is it? How about that?
Okay. Village of Hope is a village for folks on the street. We have the the goal, what we established is a sustainable village, transitional, so people can come in, be able to have a secure place to live, so that way they can access services and be able to get off the street in a timeline that works with their lifestyles, their stress, and being able to have peer counselors and all the help that they need.
And what part of town is that in?
That we established that way out on Airport Way, almost out to Gresham. So it's about as far northeast as you can get.
So can you sort of go through the, short history so far of Village of Hope? When did it come up?
We established it on Sunday, January 30th, I think it was. 28th. Time flies. Okay. So January 28th, we established it on the grounds. We set up platforms on concrete blocks. All of this is to make sure that the impact on the environment was as low as can be. We were visited. We had an open house the next day. We were visited by rangers on that day, saying, "Well, you know, that this isn't a good thing to do." And then we stayed. But by the end of the week, by Friday, those rangers were accompanied by police and other city workers, and we were escorted off the property.
And did you expect that to be happening? Sort of, did you expect it when you first started the village, and then by the time it happened, did you know it was going to be happening?
We knew that it was a possibility from the beginning. So, you know, did we expect it? We were hoping that it wouldn't. That the city would let us stay, or at least have discussion with us. By the end of the week, it was clear that they were not going to talk to us. That they were going to send the police. And then by the time Friday morning came up, we were pretty certain that it was going to happen that day.
So it seems kind of arbitrary, because obviously there are some villages that are allowed to exist and some that aren't. What is the formula to be able to have a village, I guess?
Well, I know that part of the formula for all the villages that exist is every single one had to fight. Every single one, Dignity Village had to move a number of times before they had a final place, and they had to fight for their right to survive. Right to Dream too, same thing. They've had to move. They've had to fight. The city battled them for a number of years before they were given the right. So, for us, this is the story. We are in the middle of the story of how you establish a village.
But they didn't try to negotiate with you at all. It was just, you have to go.
That's correct.
So what is the argument on their side, if we're going to play devil's advocate, or what have they told you is the reasoning for why they don't want you to be there?
They said the very first thing that we heard from the mayor's office is that we were impacting the environment negatively, that it is a natural preserve. We found out that actually the land that we were on was not a natural preserve, but it's actually an undeveloped industrial area. And it was right next to businesses that were releasing chemicals and things like that. Not necessarily horrible chemicals, but I mean, it wasn't good for a natural area. When we set up, we set it up specifically for the natural area. I mean, and then we were talking to them saying, well, which is worse, to establish a permanent camp where people can be on platforms that are above the ground, or to continually move houseless folks in the same area every 2 weeks, force them to pick up and then move on another piece of ground, pick up and move on another piece of ground? We were offering an alternative.
Yeah. And so one thing that I saw that the mayor's office said, that he thought that this unilateral action, is what he called it, basically flies in the face of what the city had been trying to do, and nonprofits and the business community, I think you mentioned. So what would you say to that?
We approve and applaud the shelters that have been set up. We said that from the beginning. We're really happy with the work that's being done and all that. The problem is that is there still a piece missing, which is that you have people who are extraordinarily stressed and traumatized by the continual sweeps that are going on. We're trying to provide a solution for that so people cannot be traumatized, but instead work on the path of getting off of the street and being able to access services.
And so what, I mean, if you're obviously not Ted Wheeler, but if you were, like, if you had were in his head, what do you think he is thinking of why he doesn't want this village to exist? Do you think it really is because of the natural area, or do you think that there's something else at play?
I think it really has to do with what he had said when he was in campaign. He said that he did not want organized camps, that was just something that in his mind he couldn't imagine that being a good thing, and mm-hmm. he's just following through on what it was that he had said there. Nevertheless, we still want to prove. I mean, I wish he would go and visit Dignity Village like we did this last week. Mm-hmm. An amazing village, an amazing place to be. That's our goal. That's what we want to see established. And honestly, what he doesn't understand is that villages are a necessary piece in the jigsaw puzzle of getting people off the street.
Sure. And have you had any support on city council?
We have not had any vocal support on city council. Uh-huh. Amanda Fritz definitely has not been supportive of us.
And is it for the same reasons you think that Ted Wheeler has not been supportive, or?
I don't know her reasons. I don't understand.
But you would think that maybe you could find some support with Chloe Udaly, or maybe Nick Fish, who is up for a re-election, you know, but there's been nothing from them whatsoever.
There's been nothing so far, but we're still, we are in the process of contacting them.
So what's next?
What is next is we're going to continue to make a presence, and then eventually we will reestablish our village, hopefully soon.
In the same location, or are you open to maybe having a different location?
Now, that would be telling. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, you don't want to play your hand too early.
Not too
early. Well, you know, I guess one thing that people, I guess the counter argument is that neighbors, Ted Wheeler was saying that neighbors have been complaining. What have you done to sort of mitigate that, or is that actually fabricated, or what is the relationship between the village and the neighbors in that community?
Certainly when we popped up, they were surprised. Mm-hmm. We didn't tell them ahead of time because we were trying to reduce the outlash before we even mm-hmm. set up. But from the time that we set up, the very day that we set up, we started talking to the neighbors. All the neighbors are businesses. There are no residential areas in the area in which we set up.
Yeah.
So it's basically a handful of businesses out there on only one, on two of the four sides that we're on. And and we were in discussion with them. I had a number of meetings with the businesses, and they were warming up to us. It was going to happen, but we weren't there long enough to really establish good relations yet.
So what's the state of the village now? It doesn't...
The state is that we're in planning for the next...
But there's no structures there currently.
In fact, the city is still holding our platforms. We expect to pick those up by the end of the week.
And it's my understanding that there were people already camping in the area up there. So, you know, it seems that any impact that an organized camp would have would actually mitigate the impact that it would have on the natural area. Is that your understanding as well?
Which is the point. The thing is that everyone that we moved into the camp were people who are already living mm-hmm. in the area. And so yeah. what we're doing is we're actually improving the area. Before we moved in, we picked up 20 bags of trash that were just laying there that the city mm-hmm. let lay. We picked it up and got it out of there.
Yeah, and I think that people don't really say it, but what they want is for houseless folks to be out of sight and out of mind, and that an organized village actually has people have to confront basically what we have going on in this city.
What I don't understand is if people really want, or the city really wants, houseless people to be out of sight and out of mind, then why are they Why are they sweeping them every other week? Mm-hmm. Why are they going around the city? This is how come we see so many camps out there, because there's no place for them to go. It's almost like they're just being punished. They're being criminalized simply for existing. Homeless folks have molecules. That means they have to exist somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so why not give them a place in which they can actually help themselves to get off the street,
yeah,
instead of forcing them to be in a place where they can't help themselves?
And I think that some people that maybe have never experienced houselessness or maybe don't know anybody or very far removed from it, think that if you make it easier, that they're not going to want to ever transition off of the streets.
I will say that having a self-managed village does not make it easier. Mm-hmm. It just is a training for regular life. It seems like that's the direction that we should want to go.
Yep, I couldn't agree with you more. So is there anybody that you want to mention or shout out for helping or anything like that that you want to?
I really want to thank, Lisa Lake got mm-hmm. us started, and there's so many folks on the street that have made this possible, I want to thank Jamie Partridge over here and sitting in the corner mm-hmm. For helping us with protests and press releases and things like that. We really, really appreciate that work. And of course, Ibrahim, who has been significant in almost every village that has gotten established in the city.
So how can people help?
People can contact Advocacy 5 or Onawim Christian Community. We also have a Village of Hope page, mm-hmm. And people can contact us, and we're definitely looking for supporters right now.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming, and it was great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. So now we're going to move into an exciting portion of the show.
No, you said slightly interesting.
Because we're introducing Catherine Stevens.
Oh,
hello,
God.
Everybody.
She is going to be helping me out in managing the personality of one Cameron Witten today. So, hi, Cameron.
Wow. I don't know what to say. This is such an honor.
Oh, my goodness.
I never get to spend an hour with you on the airwaves, Greg.
That's not true. Well, me and Sarcasm. Cameron also have a podcast together. It's called Chocolate and Caramel, and our behind-the-scenes guy is going to be so happy that I mentioned it.
Yeah, and it's on a different radio station because
Greg it's a podcast. It's
Greg
not a radio
doesn't know
show.
How to pick sides. It's being hosted on what radio station?
I don't know, but I'm all KBOO.
All KBOO.
You are such
time.
A liar.
Anyways, how are you?
You are
doing,
such
Cameron?
A liar. Oh my
How are you
gosh.
Doing, Cameron?
He knows they're listening. I can't complain, except for this is an ungodly hour.
I know.
Ungodly
when,
hour. To
when
be on
I
the
posted
radio.
About it this yeah. morning and I tagged you in it, and you jokingly said, "Wait, that was today." And at first, I was like, "Oh my goodness, Cameron!" And then I thought, "No, there's no other reason he would be up. He knows that it's today because that was at like 7 a.m.
Yeah,
yeah. So you don't usually wake up this early?
No. I work part time and I own my own business, so fortunately, I don't have to get in to work at 9 a.m. So I'm not, you know, the usual working class. And so I guess a lot of people listen to radio at 8 a.m. because they're commuting.
Yeah.
That's not me. That will never be me.
How's it feel to be part of the business community?
Yeah, Cameron.
I'm such a small, like, if there are sharks, I'm like a minnow. That's how big I am in terms of the business community.
Like,
I am like desperate when someone calls me for a gig. I'm like, yes, please, let me work with you.
And that's why you extort people, huh?
Oh, don't get me...
We'll get to it. We'll
then
get to
things
it.
Just happen. Do we have to? Oh my gosh. Anyway.
Well, okay. So if you want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187.
Please call in because this guy is harassing me already.
Well... Yeah, I am, but what else is new? But let's talk about, you know, a big story kind of hit Portland yesterday.
Hit? That's not a good word.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Arrived into the newsroom. My guest can't criticize me. That's not how it works. I could kick you out. So, but for those who don't know, somebody named Charles McGee has been accused by multiple survivors of sexual violence of different sorts. The story centered around Erica Nadeau
Campbell.
Erica Nadeau Campbell. who basically told her story of a violent assault that occurred, I think, about 5 years ago.
2011.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, yeah. So, but Charles McGee was the, he was running Black Parent Initiative.
For 11 years.
Yes. Yeah. And he was also, which has done great work in the community, and he's also was running for county commissioner. The day before this story came out, he dropped out of the race, saying that it was just not a time to be in politics. And then the story came out the next day.
And, you know, he knew the story was coming out.
Yes, so. He knew the story was coming out. And actually, Nigel from Willamette Week, who wrote the story, actually also wrote the piece saying that Charles was dropping out, and did mention the real reason why Charles was dropping out. There's also another man that's involved in the story as well, Aubrey Dixon, who's also a leader in the community. So it's a very sad story. Obviously, the Erica is very brave for coming forward with her story, but it definitely shook the community. I think, especially the Black community in Portland. Our city has the least number of or percentage of Black people out of any major city in America. So when one of our Black leaders, basically, a story comes out like this, it's a pretty big deal. So what are your initial thoughts?
I'm just gonna take a quick minute of not minute but a moment to be silent, because I just want people to reflect on the heaviness of that experience. And we just found out publicly, and I think a lot of people need to be intentional about making space for that survivor, because I think even with the title of that article, it was focused on a perpetrator, mm-hmm. and not really focused on the person who was harmed. And so I just initially want to make space for that person, because this, what happened here, was not about a specific incident. It was about a culture, a rape culture that we have in this country. And so much of that is perpetuated because we have forced conditions where women have to be brave to speak up. Mm-hmm. We've created a culture where women feel like they have no other option. And most of them, because they feel like they have no option, will say nothing and then get put in these compromising, unsafe situations. And so I'm devastated. And of course, this doubly, you know, is in my consciousness, one, because it's local, but two, because this is a reflection on leadership within the Black community. And this is gonna have, you know, long-time repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I, you know, knew since 2 days ago that this story was coming out. And I remember yesterday feeling unsettled throughout the day, just because, you know, looking through social media and seeing a lot of silence around this story, even though I know people were reading it. And that bothered me, you know, because I think I'm so grateful for the Me Too movement. It has made me elated, but it also has made me devastated, because I know that it's a little too late, way too late for this to be happening. But I'm happy it's happening now. And we've talked a lot, you know, we've seen a lot of national examples around the conversation of sexual assault, and it seemed that there was intentional silence. And that seemed unacceptable for me. When it was not happening in our community, we were so okay with bringing it up, you know, thanking the survivors, calling out rape culture, and then it happened here. And I've seen it happen before with many other controversial things. And I said, this is enough. And I think it's important to be nuanced. I think it's important to be intentional and considerate, but I think you can't be silent.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I've never met Erica Nadel Campbell. We might never meet. She might not hear this on the radio, but I think this is bigger than validating her. But we need to be validating all survivors. And this should just be an example of how we continue needing to do more because we keep messing it up.
Yeah. And I, you know, when Roy Moore happened or these sorts of things, everybody was very quick to post multiple times, or even Senator Cruz in the Oregon legislature, who's accused of a lot of things as well, and inappropriate behavior, who's a Republican. We see a lot more outcry, and that was, you know, somewhat in our community. But when it's somebody that shares the same politics as us, or has done a lot in the community, there's oftentimes much more silence. And, you know, I think what is very sad about this to me is that it seems as though he was able to sort of leverage the power that he had built in the community to be committing these acts. And so it's just a really sad story to have happening. Do you have other thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thought is this is an important time for healing. And I think the takeaway that I have is that Charles is now out the race, and now it paves the way for a woman to become the next county commissioner. We have three women of color running for that position, and I think that that's such a cogent kind of situation to follow what has just happened. And I think this is something that men in the city and around the country need to be thinking about, and especially I think Stuart Emmons, who recently this same week announced that he is running for a city council position against three women of color. So I think that men all around need to realize that this is not just about being a perpetrator, but this is about men clinging and clawing onto positions of power that constantly make it so difficult for women to speak up when they are victims of oppression. So this is big. This is sends shockwaves for so many reasons. But ultimately, I have hope that we will heal from this. And my endless gratitude goes to Erica Nato Campbell and all other survivors who have told their stories over the years.
Yeah, and it's also very, I don't know, it's heavy that it, had he not been running for office, this probably would have never happened.
It's true.
And
this is hearsay, but I've had conversations with people, you know, since yesterday, private conversations, and it's my understanding that there have been some people within Charles's former organization who knew.
Wow.
So it is. And I so for me, like, some people still ask, which, you know, I don't think some people who have not lived in proximity to sexual assault will ask really tone deaf and harmful questions, such as like, oh, why'd she wait till now to say something? Mm-hmm. And people need to realize she probably did say something and nothing happened. Mm. Why would she keep speaking up when it's traumatizing for her to speak up and nothing's happened? The time has changed now. Me Too is happening. People are listening, and he was running for office.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense that she thought that this was the time to draw the line in the sand. And I'm glad people listened.
And the story also highlights that she had been telling, you know, this was not like something that just came up because he was running. She had told multiple people in the past that sort of corroborated her telling. Do you have any thoughts, Kat?
I don't know. I'm very curious if we were in 2015, 2014, if this story would have even been picked up. It's really, it's very comforting that she got to have her story was heard and that something came of it. Yeah. I mean, that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note that it's not just political power that people have, but in our society, in the way that our world is structured, men always have a little more power than you. Even if it's someone that you just went to college with that assaulted you, and you see them in the hallways, they have more pull than you do. And it makes it so much harder to speak up about what happened then. But to see someone like rising in the political ranks and have political power in your city and real pull and real attachment to your community to speak up then is so powerful. It's
So that's a lot. I think that we, you know, had to talk about it. It happened yesterday. And I think, you know, obviously Cameron and I are two black male leaders in our community. And so it would have been irresponsible to not touch on it.
And my hope is that people who endorse him, and I'm not saying that people have supported Charles over the years knowing this, but we as a community have given this person power, and I think it's important to recognize that we did that and recognize that we have to be accountable for the healing and the fear that we invoked within the survivor, because I'm sure it was very afraid, very scary for that person to speak up, knowing that this person had so much power and support based off of our community. So I think that people who have supported Charles in the past need to recognize that this woman took all of our previous positions into consideration when speaking up, and we should own that and thank her.
Yeah. So again, the number to call in is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187 if you want to be on the air. So moving on to another subject, would you rather talk about what you're doing around town right now or about drama? I know you love drama.
I love drama.
Okay, let's do it.
I love drama. All right.
So let's talk about, and sort of within the lens, you know, I don't want to just be trashing people, but sort of in the lens of the shortcomings that activism in Portland has, and sort of the problems that occur, especially to people of color who are activists in the city. As we know, so many of us have moved away or stopped organizing, or basically been shunned or something like that. So you recently had sort of a, let's say, what, how would you characterize it? Well, you called out a local activist group that's very prominent, and that I think a lot of people recognize does good work.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think if people want more information, a Medium article came out January 3rd of this year, and the organization was Portland Tenants United. I encourage you to read that article if you don't already know the story. But I would say that...
Well, we have time. Tell us a little bit of the story.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
people already probably know. Anyways, you're gonna get me in trouble. You're gonna get yourself in trouble. Anyways, PTU's probably gonna know about this, and they're gonna be very upset that this is coming on air. And I know that because the reaction to my Medium article was devastating, and I think on one side I was really grateful because most of the people who read the article thanked me for speaking up. However, what devastated me was that the people who I wrote the article for, which were members, supporters of PTU, there was no gratitude. There was actually hostility. And people really have doubled down in harassing me, attacking me, assaulting my character, spreading conspiracy theories about me, blocking me, sending people in droves to harass me, spreading more rumor, all kinds of stuff. And I lost a lot of sleep about it. And after a week, I said to my, you know, I said, like, I was recognizing how I was internalizing all of this oppression and how I was letting these unapologetic abusers continue to have power over me. And I'm in a fortunate place because this is not the same as sexual assault, but, you know, there was abuse going on and I was able to just be like, okay, well, I'm going to move past it because obviously I did what I could to let people know what was happening, and I can't force anybody to be accountable. So I've checked out. And since Greg brought it up, and I know why Greg's bringing it up, it's because my article is mostly about Margot Black, who's the co-founder and poster child for Portland Tenants United, and she has not communicated to me once since the article came out.
How do you know that's why I'm bringing it up?
It just happened last night. Anyways, because it was over a month ago.
I sent you these questions a week ago.
I'm sorry. This thing happened over a month ago. I don't know why we keep talking about it. Well, but anyways.
Because I haven't been able to have you on the air since then. But
we talked about it twice on the podcast. Anyways, let me finish this part.
Okay.
So anyways, you know, Margot Black had me blocked on Facebook since August. So we've not talked since then, even though I've not said anything to her that I would say condones being blocked. The reason why she blocked me was Not because I said anything to her specifically, is because I publicly resigned from PTU. So that's why I say that I don't think that I deserve being blocked. I publicly resigned from PTU because I had issues with their racism, and she was so offended that I would resign and call them out that she blocked me. And so the first that she ever responded to me was an email last night at 6 p.m. And basically there's been a conspiracy spreading through PTU that my Medium article originally had extremely misogynistic language that I used against Margo, and they can't find that language, but they still think that within like the first 20 minutes of my article going out that I had this misogynistic language, like anti-women language, and then I changed it. And so Margo asked me for screenshots of my revision history of my article, and I sent her it because I decided to, which is her gaslighting, continuing to gaslight a victim. And I sent it to her because I do believe in transparency. I didn't say words to her, I just sent her the screenshot. Then she emailed me again saying, to paraphrase, that screenshot was not good enough. I need you to edit your article, then send me another screenshot to show that you didn't Photoshop your whatever you just sent me or whatever. So I had to like double verify to her that the gaslighting they were doing was unfounded. So yeah, I'm stressed out with the situation. I've had to just stay away. And to be honest, I told myself, you know, earlier this week that I've been burnt out from Portland activism. I've been, you know, involved with direct action and grassroots groups since 2011, and I'm surprised. I've seen a lot and I've been through a lot, but I think when I decided to check out PTU, I had already felt burned from other organizations, and I thought I could work with PTU because I admired their work. I admired their leadership, their results in the community, and then once I got there, it was just worse than any other situation in terms of me personally experiencing hostility, not being welcome. So at this time being, I don't feel comfortable being close in proximity to different activist groups. And I think a lot of people have had that experience in the past. Mm. And it's so sad that we as people with, you know, future focused politics who focus on justice movements and justice building, we do not have accountability in our own communities. We do not, we always decry oppression from the top down. We, you know, decry the criminal justice process. We decry policing. But when it comes to us being accountable for our own actions, we have failed time and time again. And it's sad that we don't talk about it and we don't prioritize it, because that's the reason why we don't have capacity. We continue to mess up. You can see how hard I am trying to not cuss. That's why I can't be a radio host, because I love to cuss. But we mess up so much and we don't do anything about it. And so my just hope, and this is nothing to do with my story, I just continue to send my hope and vibes out to the activist community in Portland that we can do better to each other.
So if we just take a step back from the specific organizations and such, I think that some people might be listening and be like, oh, well, they, you know, not PTU specifically, but activists in general in Portland are the most woke people in the city. They go to the marches, they post Black Lives Matter, they might have a bumper sticker, like all of these things. So how do you think, not why, but how does white supremacy sort of manifest itself within activist communities? What does that look like?
It manifests in so many ways. And I think Portland needs to have a reckoning with its community. I recently created this term called racial disengagement, and it basically talks about it highlights the fact that racism isn't always this active thing. It can be passive. And racial disengagement specifically is looking at the fact that for white culture, it can exist perfectly fine without being in proximity, without having to interface with any people of color. And so that is based off of who your friends are. It's based off of where you live, your family, the language that you speak, the food that you eat. White people, to some degree or another, are not engaged with the experience of people of color. And in Portland, it's even much so because of our demographics. And there are a lot of people who make a conscious or unconscious choice to not be close to the struggle of people of color. And so that's a reckoning that we have to be honest with. We can't just keep saying that racism is calling a country a bad hole or being a neo-Nazi. Racism also is not being close to the experiences of people of color, because our struggles get ignored when people are not able to have relations with us and are not able to embrace the truth of our experience. And as MLK said, this is stuff that human rights leaders have been saying for generations. Just as MLK said, silence is the tool of the oppressor. I'm more worried about my moderates than I am about the people against me. And that's because of racial disengagement. Those who really have the power and are somewhat sympathetic to our cause are the ones who still don't engage for one reason or another. And we need people to wake up and to realize that we don't need to be disengaged. We don't need to be segregated. We need real solidarity. And that's going to take folks who think they're woke to sometimes be quiet and follow the leadership and voices of those more oppressed than them.
Mm-hmm. And so moving towards how do we fix it? You know, what can these groups do? Maybe specifically ones that have harmed specific individuals. What can they do? And then maybe on a more broader sense, how should activist groups be trying to avoid engaging in such harmful white supremacy?
Well, we need to honor survivors. And I mean that both to acute victims, but also the more chronic victims, such as racial injustice. We don't talk about oppression as real harm, whether it's medical or social harm. Like, these are traumatized people, and we need to heal from injustice, whether it's racism, sexism, genderism, all the things. And so that means listening to survivors. All oppressed people are survivors of some kind of cultural genocide. And so that's what I think we need to do better of. We, you know, before we even work on, because, for example, somebody looked at the story yesterday and they said, let's start talking about redemption. And I'm like, whoa, how did we already get the story of redemption when this person just got busted for what they did? So we need to start off with healing for the survivor. Nothing about the perpetrator. We have to highlight and hold sacred the experience of the people who experience the greatest trauma. And that's the first thing the activist community needs to do. And once that gets done, then we can start talking about restorative justice. But it all plays in together, and I think we all just need to figure out what it means to be gentle to those who have the most baggage based off of society. But with that, I guess I'll talk a little bit about my work right now.
No. We'll get into that.
God. All right. Go ahead.
Dang it. Anyways.
Is Dale a cuss word? I don't know.
But yeah, like, what happens? Does it bleep out? Does somebody drag us out of here?
We get arrested. There will be police sitting outside of the studio.
This is why I'm not talking.
You don't even cuss. Yeah.
Be quiet.
Anyways. You want to take some calls? We have some callers.
Yeah, let's do some callers.
Who do we got? James, you're on the line. Is it James Offsync?
It's James. James Ortega. I don't know. Anyway, no, you're absolutely right. I was reading part of that article, and I think what we need to realize is that we prioritize the voices of some other people. I mean, look at the situation with Rose McGowan. Tarana Burke started the Me Too movement 10 years ago, but now Rose McGowan's got Citizen Rose. She's got this book out called Brave. And then you saw that meltdown at Barnes & Noble talking about, I don't come from your planet, don't put your labels on me, sister.
And just to interrupt, because some people might not know, there was a trans person who spoke up saying, hey, can we speak about trans people who experience more violence? And Rose is like, how dare you call me cis? How dare you do all these things? Yeah.
Exactly. But see, we prize white, we put white saviorism over black victimization, or people victimization of marginalized communities, because of our history, we automatically assume that whiteness is innocence and color or things that aren't of what we consider cis straight white. Those things are weird. They're not in the spectrum of things that we can talk about or things that we can see as automatically good. So when you have somebody who's an outspoken voice like Margot Black for Portland Tenants United, who You know, because it's just a thing. People don't realize when people of color talk about, you know, the white people stuff, it's like we're so entrenched in white supremacy that when we start calling out what stuff is white, and even people of color who are in proximity to whiteness all the time will get uncomfortable, like, hey, that's not okay. But then when people make passing jokes about Mexicans or black people or trans people or whatever, you know, it's like, oh, haha, it's fine. Nobody meant anything by that. But we don't think about the power differential. We don't think about the societal influence because of the type of place that white people hold in society. So, and especially now, I mean, how we have so much focus on, you know, because we think of activists, I mean, people don't realize that a lot of the ideas, a lot of the systems for white, what we consider activism, were coined by black folks. You know, we don't realize, or, you know, like you think about intersectionality, that's a popular word, but nobody really knows the meaning of it, kind of like karma. People say it, but they don't understand exactly what it means. Yeah. Intersectionality doesn't mean that we get to just become this huge melting pot of issues. It's saying that people... Yes. That people can cross many different lines of marginalization, and we really need to look at those lines, not just being a woman, but also being a woman of color, not just being a woman and a woman of color, but also being a woman of color, and a woman who
disability,
is lesbian,
low income.
Or bi.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's because we like to box things because it's easier to organize, but life is a spectrum. It's not. Mm. It's not an organized little drawer where it's the spoons and forks and knives all go in one place. So no, I mean because of Portland's history of white activism, having white folks being called out on their passive racist tendency, like you said, racial disengagement. It's like it hurts their feelings. Like, how can you be so mean when I didn't even know what I was doing? Or, and it's like, you ought to know. you're a quote unquote woke person.
Yep.
Figure it out.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, go on, do what you do. Don't even listen to these haters. You know, they want to shut you down because they want the feel good truth. They want the feel good feeling of watching Justin Timberlake at the Super Bowl.
Oh man, don't get me started.
But they don't want to understand that Prince. But they don't want to understand Prince's side of it. They don't want to understand that Justin Timberlake dissed Prince several times in public. But but let's just talk about the feel good music. Let's all feel good about something.
Yeah.
So go on, do what you do. Love you. Take care.
Love you too, James. I love KBOO callers.
Yeah, that was great.
That was great.
So, but I think that there is a lot of important points made there. And I think that intersectionality is something that is said a lot in Portland and maybe other places. I've just lived in Portland my whole life. But sometimes it's used as, because I'm from a marginalized community, I understand whatever you're going through because of your marginalized identity, right? But really what it's supposed to mean is that these sort of things sort of can compound and such, but it's not to say that all forms of oppression are the same.
And it's also used to say that one form of identity, and historically has been used to invalidate others. A great example is the women's movement, which since its inception has always been about white women, and we're now trying to make a multicultural women's movement. But even now there's tone deaf women who will be like, oh yeah, we're here for all women. But you need to know that that's been said forever and it's never been true. And you're causing harm to a lot of women of color when you keep saying that. When somebody tries to correct you, you just double down and you talk a lot of crap.
And I think that historically, a lot of people might not know about this, but there are basically a huge conflicts that occur between white women and people of color, and specifically sometimes black men. And so...
About who's more oppressed or whatever.
Yeah, the oppression Olympics. And it's existed...
We don't have Joanne here to give the answer.
Well, yeah, but it, I mean, and it's existed. I know when I was at your training the other day, I was talking about Ida B. Wells, who was a leader in the Black community, specifically for women of color, back during the women's suffrage movement times, and basically was invited to speak around with Susan B. Anthony, and they burned her. And it's very similar to, I think, what's gone on with the Women's March, both across the country, but especially even here in Portland. And I think that it's something that people need to realize, even if you, and especially in Portland, where we have people from a lot of different marginalized identities and that are oppressed in many different forms. But all oppression is not the same. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously there's a big problem with patriarchy and sexism and misogyny, and we saw it with Charles McGee, where a Black man is able to take advantage of a white woman. But you know, it's sort of a way that we have that there has been a divide, and I think that we need to be looking at oppression sort of through a different lens. Do you have any thoughts on that, either of you?
No, I agree.
Cool. It must have been great. Let's take another. let's take another caller. Let's see. We have Johnny on the line.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, Johnny.
I'm here to say that you guys are absolutely amazing. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you okay. Say that again.
Yeah. Wait, one more time for the listeners.
You guys, let me put it to you this way. There are many of the older people of the generations mm-hmm. that are very afraid to bring up the subject matter that you're bringing
yeah.
up. And I applaud what you're doing down there at KBOO, and you guys should like yeah. come on like every day if you could.
Call KBOO and let them know.
No, you guys are amazing, and I'll tell you why. Because, okay, everyone's talking about intersectionality. Yeah, intersectionality, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep this simple. Because I'm noticing how a lot of things are getting obfuscated with what white supremacy really is
mm-hmm.
and what it means to be African-American, descendant of slave, and a Latino, and a woman, and all that. And they all have one thing in common, and that's economics. Now, what do you mean economics? Economics is if you want to maintain your supremacy, and prevent the other person from having equality with you, you have to keep your boot on their neck economically. Black people, especially before 1965, broke their necks trying to have some type of economic equality. And every time that equality was almost achieved, it was slapped back down again.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So it's not intersectionality. True racism is all about money and access to wealth.
Hmm.
And access to money, especially in the United States of America. We don't live in Russia, you know, communist or socialist societies. We live in the United States of America. I have yet to see a rich Black person who lives in a rich neighborhood with lots of money in the background, I mean, in the banking, to get
in banking,
shot and
yeah.
killed. Excuse, yes.
Okay.
In banking.
Yeah.
I have yet to see a Black person who has lots of money in the bank. Who lives in a nice neighborhood.
Well, Johnny,
hold
please...
up, let me finish.
Okay.
And I'll let you take over. And I have yet to see a Black man with lots of money that lives in a good neighborhood get shot and killed by a police officer over a minor traffic violation. Mm-hmm.
So what I'll say, because I agree with you on many points, is, I think my disagreement is that I do think that the economic oppression is a major part, but I think there are other parts that are non-economic, mainly legal, but also social. And actually, to contrast your opinion, your point about Black men, we don't talk a lot about the death of Black women, and that's usually a slow death. There are women who are Black women shot by the police, but they also die slowly from the effects of. But look at Black women who are high income and who still die after childbirth within months of giving birth. So there is an epidemic of Black women.
Regardless, you say high income. I would have to see the data on that.
No, the data is there. When they control for everything, including income, Black women are still overrepresented in childbirth death. If we did not have Black women included in our childbirth deaths, instead of U.S. being like Nicaragua or some third world country, we would be close to the U.K. in terms of women not dying after birth. That's okay, how bad the epidemic is with black women, and that's controlled
I'm not doubting the epidemic, yeah. But I have a feeling that you might be able to line the metrics up with poverty and money.
No, they've already done it. So I think if you want my contact info, I can send you information. The CDC has already done the information. There's
a
great article.
You could gladly read it over the air and tell us where to go, and we could go, because in this country there's a direct connection between healthcare and economics. And
please.
And one more, you will have to be more specific about what high income is in the United States, because that's a very general word. Now, if you say between a $100,000 mark and a $300,000 mark, I'll definitely have to look that up.
Please Google the name Shalon Irving. NPR did a great story about her last year. She was a woman who had a PhD, worked as an epidemiologist for the Centers of Disease Control. Black woman died within 3 weeks of giving childbirth. And that story has references. I'm just telling you that
normal?
This is a great story that has references to
normal?
This.
It's
normal.
We're not talking about an individual. We're talking about an entire group of
people. I'm just telling you to look at the article so you can see that the article includes data that's not just about her but about other people. That's why I said her name, because the article has other information.
Okay, well, you're talking about something that is abnormal, and I'll give you that.
Okay, I'll just end by saying that I believe that the solution to
it is about economics, it's about money, and if you deny that money, that entire group will just I have yet to see rich people go through that much. And
okay,
I'll let you go at that.
So what I'll say is that I believe the response to racism is reparations, and most of reparations is economic reparations. So that's what I'm going to agree with you there. We got to shift the keys of power to make it happen.
Yeah, and I think that that's why, I mean, Martin Luther King died in a city where he was fighting with unions, right? Mm-hmm. And labor. And so if, you know, we talk about intersectionality, the intersection between poverty and blackness or people of color is definitely one that is huge. I think we have another caller on the line.
Last caller.
Edie!
Hey, love.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you,
Edie. What you doing tonight?
Well, I am so grateful for you bringing up these topics and presenting it the way you did, and Cameron, for the moment of silence and really focusing on looking at the survivors. I agree with everything you're saying, and I was going to add to new points in the time of waiting. You got those points in. I'm so proud of you, and I'm so grateful.
Aww.
I think it's both very complicated and very simple. I think our dominant culture, corporate agenda, the economic vested interest, would have us just look at a narrow little line, if you're kind of looking on a vertical axis, and we forget the deeper, more detailed stuff below and the common roots, and we forget and we don't look at the bigger and where it stretches out. The simple is, it doesn't matter who does it to whom, it's wrong. Do sexual and physical assault, accusation, violence, harassment, it's wrong no matter what. That's simple, and the survivors need to have protection and care. We need to have better legislation. We need to have a societal support, and we need to have accountability at all levels, and it's not just through our schools and our churches and our media. The complicated is that in order to have these economic vested interests, race has been created as a social construct, and then it proceeds past the class. So we've had professors, we've had judges, we've had people who are black who have by some people standard a sense of wealth, and they are still harassed and still called by cops. And yes, there's very good research and read it about no matter where one is in one's education, one's health going in, one's economics, one's behavior, how and when about the birth and the prenatal care, black women are dying with medically inexcusable on preventable conditions. Mm-hmm. And that is because of racism regardless of class, even though the racism was developed because of class. And then also, I think we have to be, another complication is you have to be careful. Sometimes, through the Black Panthers, et cetera, women of color were oppressed and they kept silence in order to help the brotherhood of the race. And exploited.
Oh, there's 30 seconds left. So, Edie, we have to wrap up. Yeah, so I want to do a final plug
FBI,
about the... Edie, we're out of time. Edie, we're out of time. So, final plug. I just wanted you to see if you could do a shout-out of where you're going to be tonight.
She's gone.
So Edie's going to be graduating from my most recent endeavor where I'm working with white allies on racial education and how to be a dynamic anti-racist ally. And so we've had 8 sessions together with Equity Beyond. Edie has been wonderful enough to bring bread to the cohort and working with 15 other people who are trying to be woke. It's not an end goal. It's not a finish line, but we're still in the process and we're graduating from our 8th session today. And I'm so happy to be working with Edie and so many other people. And I think it's a big part of it is that we have to continue talking about race, learning about it, and realizing that we have so much more to learn. And I appreciate anybody who's engaged with that work.
Thank you, Cameron, for coming on. And thank you, Kat, for helping out.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning. It is 8:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Sojourner Truth Radio. It presents a conversation with former Black Panther leader and decades-long political prisoner Marshall Eddie Conway. KBOO has just started our Kickstarter campaign just today. Help us build a city of media makers by going to Kickstarter and search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
We're given an opportunity to share our stories, opinions, thoughts, and ideas in a meaningful manner with each other over airwaves. Not only does it increase our collective knowledge of what it means to be human, but our stories also have the potential to influence the public dialogue. This is the power of KBOO. You can help expand the conversation, invest in future media makers, and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Community radio is radio for the people, by the people. At KBOO, your neighbors, coworkers, and friends make radio so you can be sure that the issues they bring to you are the issues that matter. We believe strong communities invest in sharing knowledge with each other. Every month, KBOO offers free classes in the art of radio broadcasting so Portland can stay informed. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO is a drop-off site for art supplies from now until March 5th. We're collecting them to support the walk entitled Water is Life, for those yet to come. The walk aims to address climate change, discuss renewable energy options, and also to share the learnings of Standing Rock with our youth. The walkers will stop by schools and community centers to engage the community in creating murals expressing identity and visions for the future. Art supplies needed for creating murals include Nova Color acrylic mural paint, rollers, trays, buckets,